The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Welcome to tonight's very exciting event, Martin Sherwin's Oppenheimer's Shadow, His Nuclear World, and Ours. I am Toshi Hasegawa of History and also co-director of the Center for Cold War Studies. Before I introduce tonight's speaker, I'd like to take this opportunity to say a few words about the Center for Cold War Studies. Center for Cold War Studies was founded in 1994 when there was a major excitement about the study of the Cold War after the archives, former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, suddenly opened up. And a group of faculty and graduate students with diverse disciplines and specialty got together and discussed the new issues that arose from a new evidence. From this humble beginning, we called ourselves, at that time, Cold War History Group, COWHIG. And we organized annual graduate students' conferences, invited leading historians on the Cold War to campus, organized Cold War film showing, and held small workshops where we read each other's papers and chapters. In 2002, COWHIG became grown to be Center for Cold War Studies, which became already well-known nationally and internationally. And I'm pleased to say that the graduate student conference we started became so popular, attracting many graduate students all over the United States and abroad. Other universities began imitating us. And so rather than competing with them, in other words, engaging the Cold War with them, we decided to collaborate with them, and we fostered some collaboration, and the graduate student became three-university collaborative, a three-way collaboration with UCSB, George Washington University, and London School of Economics. We organize a number of events, and you'll see some of the forthcoming events of the in the flyers at the entrance. And if you're interested in the program, you can go to our website or take a look at the flyer and sign up in the mailing list. One of the missions of the Center for Cold War Studies is to bring scholarship to the university community and the communities and the Santa Barbara community. And tonight's event is one of a good example of this. And I am so pleased to see so many of you here. So now, without further ado, I would like to introduce tonight's speaker. It is my great privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, Professor Martin Sherwin. He has been the Walter S. Dickinson Professor of English and American History at Tufts University for 25 years. In the fall of 2007, he'll move to George Mason University in Fairfax as the university's university professor of history. As you know, his most recent book he co-authored with Kai Bird, American Prometheus. The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer won the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for Biography. That's not the only one. The National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography and the English Speaking Union Book Award. And Time Magazine selected this book as one of the six best nonfiction books of 2005, and New York Times listed it as one of the 50 best nonfiction books of that year. In addition to the American Prometheus, Professor Sherwin is also the author of A World Destroyed, The Atomic Bomb and Grand Alliance, which won the Bernath Prize awarded by the Society of Historians of American Foreign Relations, as well as the American History Book Prize awarded by National Historical Society. I didn't know, but this book was 1976 finalist for both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. So that you can see that he has a really good track record. And so Professor Sherwin has received fellowship, many fellowships. I'm not going to bother to read here. But as you can see, that he is a well-sought-out speaker. And when I contacted him first, I was with trepidation that, it might be very difficult to convince him to come to UCSB. And he very readily agreed to come. I think this is not because of the weather in February. I understand it's a very deep freeze in Washington. But also, I think this is the reputation of UCSB as a center of the Cold War studies. So please welcome Professor Sherwin.
Thank you very much. But truth be told, it was the weather. No, I don't mean that. But let me tell you, I left D.C. yesterday. It was absolutely freezing. And I woke up, I got here about 1 in the morning. I had questioned the idea of coming here on a red eye, but boy, when I woke up this morning and the sun was shining, I knew I had done the right thing. What a beautiful place. It's a pleasure to be here for many, many reasons. A lot of them are personal. My good friend Ed Baer from high school, who I've known since 1953, is in the audience and has lived here for 33 years. Somebody in our high school knew what they were doing, and I think it was Ed. One of my favorite students from Tufts University, Norman Orenstein, is in the audience, and that's very nice. My mentor and very dear friend, Keith Berwick, who is responsible for anything good that I have done in this profession, is here, and some other people, too. So I'm very happy to be here for many reasons. Toshi, thank you so much for the very nice introduction. Before I begin, what I'd like to do is acknowledge what Toshi has already said, that American Prometheus was written with Kai Bird, and of course, this talk is based on that book. I'm talking about Oppenheimer's shadow, his nuclear world, and ours, and the analogies between what happened then, so to speak, and the problems we're dealing with now are extremely, extremely to the point. Now, there are many interesting moments in Robert Oppenheimer's life that I could choose to begin this lecture. I could, for example, begin with a description of the environment into which he was born. the Upper West Side of New York City at the turn of the century, into a wealthy German-Jewish family that was determined to be 100% American. I could describe his years at the Ethical Culture School, which had such a powerful influence on shaping his mind and his values. Or I could describe the difficult childhood he had, pampered by an overprotective mother, devoid of real friendships, a childhood which, not surprisingly, had a powerful influence on shaping his personality. His undergraduate days at Harvard were also interesting and relatively brief. It took him only 3 years to graduate summa cum laude, like most of the rest of us, I'm sure. But even more interesting was his first postgraduate year at Cambridge University in England. There, frustrated by his failure to succeed intellectually, the very first time he had failed to succeed intellectually, and this was as an experimental physicist, he came close to committing suicide. In addition, he was almost expelled from Cambridge for leaving a so-called poison apple on the desk of his tutor. But he left England and went to Germany, and as a graduate student in Germany, those years were much more successful and much happier. He discovered quantum physics there. He fell in love with the subject and began to develop into the mature character and the personality that the world came to know two decades later. Another very good beginning would be the 1930s, during which Oppenheimer was a professor of physics at the University of California, Berkeley, and at Caltech. After a shaky start as a lecturer, his students thought that he was going to write on the board with a cigarette and puff the chalk constantly. He was always doing very weird things. He talked very low, and you could hardly hear what he was saying, and he talked very fast. He was a terrible lecturer at the beginning. But he transformed himself within a couple of years into not only an engaging speaker, but a charismatic professor. But even more to the point for our purposes this evening, in 1936, he became a serious political activist, working for desegregation, the rights of farm workers, a teachers' union, and other left-of-center causes. He became, during those years, a fellow traveler, which meant that he was very close to the Communist Party, but not a member of it. But his first serious love, Jean Tatlock, was an on-and-off member of the Communist Party. And his wife, who he met and married in 1941, had been a communist, had been married to a Communist Party official who had been killed in 1937 during the Spanish Civil War. Robert's younger brother, Frank, and Frank's wife, Jackie, were party members, as were many of Oppenheimer's students and his friends. Now, all this is important, as you'll see, because after World War II, Oppenheimer's critics would use these associations to call his loyalty into question. But the primary focus of our discussion this evening is Oppenheimer's nuclear world and ours. So I'll begin to focus on that issue by turning our attention to July 1945. More precisely, to 5:30 in the morning of July 16, 1945, in a part of New Mexico, in the New Mexico desert called Alamogordo. And here I get a chance to do something I have always wanted to do in a public lecture. I get to quote Snoopy. It was a dark and stormy night. And it was. But at precisely 5:30 a.m., a plutonium bomb exploded with a force of 20,000 tons of TNT. That successful test marked a great divide in human history. On the far side were almost 10,000 years of war and peace, degradation and progress. In short, the fantastic sum of human history. On the near side was a new incredible fact. Human beings would soon be able to annihilate all life on Earth, to destroy everything, our species included. It was as if that explosion in the New Mexico desert had suddenly shifted an active volcano under all of human existence. Suddenly, Mount Vesuvius and Pompeii were the appropriate metaphors for the new world. In 2007, the nuclear volcano that threatens humanity appears less active than it was in 1982, or certainly than it was in 1962, the year of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But it remains active nevertheless, and we ignore it at our peril. Robert Oppenheimer perceived those dangers on that fateful morning of July 16, 1945, and my talk centers on his efforts, alas, his failed efforts, to convince the government of the United States that in the long run, a decision to rely on nuclear weapons would bring far more danger than security to the United States. No single person can sensibly be credited or blamed for creating the nuclear age. But from among all of the engineers, scientists, politicians, military personnel, and corporate leaders of the Manhattan Project, as the wartime atomic bomb program was known, Oppenheimer, the so-called father of the atomic bomb, stands out. Just 5.5 years after the discovery of nuclear fission, Robert Oppenheimer, at the age of 41, emerged from the war as America's most celebrated scientist. The atomic fires that allegedly hastened the end of the war marked Oppenheimer's triumphant and transformative moment. He had devoted himself totally to achieving it. He had been a magnificently and uniquely effective scientific leader of Los Alamos. And there is no doubt that it was Oppenheimer who made it possible to have two atomic bombs ready to be used in August of 1945. To his colleagues, he appeared exhilarated by his success, but his wife knew better. In the days after Hiroshima, Oppenheimer plunged into a deep depression, and his wife, Kitty, wrote to a friend, "Robert has just definitely been beside himself." The enormity of what had happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki had affected him profoundly. In too many ways, in too many instances, for his humanistic soul, the soul that his ethical culture education had done so much to form, Oppenheimer had made the bombings possible. He had not just consented to them, he had encouraged them. He had participated in the targeting of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the bullseye of each city being its civilian center, not a military facility. He had been a member of two committees in which the use of the bomb was discussed. He could have said, "No, don't use it." But he had supported his use. As the director of the Los Alamos Laboratory, he had intervened to prevent a petition against the use of the bomb from being passed around Los Alamos. And he had stifled discussions initiated by other scientists about whether it was appropriate to continue work on the bomb after the surrender of Germany on May 8, 1945. He had, in other words, uncritically supported the scientists' two crusades, the first one being the race against Germany, the second one being the race against the end of the war. The first crusade was unambiguously defensible, but the second created a moral dilemma for Oppenheimer and for others after the war. He had supported the rush to complete the bomb before the war ended, believing there was no other alternative to using than to using the bomb, either that or invading Japan. That is what he had been led to believe. But after the war, he learned differently. He learned that the invasion of Japan was months away, November 1st, 1945. He learned that the Japanese, and this included the emperor himself, had begun to seek surrender terms as early as June, the main obstacle being a call for unconditional surrender, a demand that appeared to put the emperor's life in jeopardy. He learned that if President Truman had been willing to clarify the status, the post-war status of the emperor, as Secretary of War Henry Stimson had urged, that single initiative might have led to Japan's surrender in June or July. The Secretary of War believed this and stated it in print in 1948 in his memoirs on active service in peace and war. He learned, too, that the Soviets had promised and planned, and in fact did, come into the war before August 15th. And as it was generally believed, their entry would certainly precipitate Japan's surrender. Now, the reason for this, by the way, is that Japan's military leaders had built their case for continuing the war on the proposition that Japan could induce the Soviet Union to mediate with the United States on behalf of Japan for better surrender terms than unconditional surrender. He came to believe, in other words, that what Professor Hao Sagawa has written and made clear in Racing the Enemy, since he held up my book, I'll hold up his book. It's a wonderful book. He came to believe that all of these things that Professor Hasegawa points out were true. The United States government knew all of this. Japan's diplomatic code had been broken in 1939 and had been monitored throughout the war. Oppenheimer had learned that from this experience that even an important scientific leader of an extremely important military project could be lied to and manipulated. And with this knowledge, which shattered his naivete, he determined he would never be so naive again. Henceforth, he would think through on his own the issues related to nuclear and defense policy. Well, within weeks, Oppenheimer began to voice his fears about the new weapons consequences. During a visit to Washington in October, he told United States senators that there was no defense against this weapon, and because the United States was a highly urbanized society, it posed a far greater danger to us than it did to the Soviets. On that trip, he also spoke with former Vice President Henry A. Wallace, who wrote in his diary, quote, "Oppenheimer seemed to feel that the destruction of the entire human race was imminent." Wallace therefore encouraged Oppenheimer to see President Truman. And on October 25th, 1945, 6 days after his meeting with Wallace, Oppenheimer was ushered in to the Oval Office. Now, before describing the Truman-Oppenheimer conversation, I want to turn your attention to the subtitle of today's event, Oppenheimer's Nuclear World and Ours. I'm speaking about a sliver of that enormous topic, a case study at the dawn of the nuclear age, a moment when a range of significant choices were available to our government. It was a time when roads not taken could have been, and in Oppenheimer's view, those alternative roads should have been taken. And I must remind you of this. Nothing in human history that flowed from the decisions of governments has been inevitable. No historical event had to happen as it happened. The counterfactual, the could have been in history, is a unique and essential aspect of human intelligence. Alternatives always have been available, and they always will be available. To believe otherwise is the historical equivalent of intelligent design, an oxymoron if there ever was one. It's this fact that there are always alternatives that makes Oppenheimer's efforts to prevent a nuclear arms race relevant and important today. But back to the Oval Office. Truman opened up the conversation saying, "The first thing is to define the national problem with respect to nuclear weapons." Oppenheimer responded that in his view, the first imperative was to stop the spread of nuclear weapons internationally by placing controls over atomic technology, international controls. Truman, however, already regarded the atomic bomb as an American asset, and he did not share Oppenheimer's concerns. Suddenly, out of nowhere, it seemed, the president asked Oppenheimer, "When do you think the Soviets will get an atomic bomb?" And it came in the point in the conversation that it took Oppenheimer back, and his reply was, "I don't know," which was curious because this very point had been discussed several months later at length during a meeting of the interim committee before the bomb was used. And Oppenheimer and Vannevar Bush and James Conant, the other scientists, had all agreed they could do it in 3 to 5 years. But Oppenheimer said to Truman, "I don't know." And Truman confidently answered, "I know. The answer is never." Now, for Oppenheimer, this ignorant attitude was proof of Truman's limitations. The incomprehension it showed just knocked the heart out of him, a friend recalled. As for Truman, who camouflaged his insecurities with a shallow decisiveness, Oppenheimer seemed obscure and uncertain. Finally, sensing that the president was not comprehending the deadly urgency of his message, Oppenheimer foolishly blurted out, "Mr. President, I have blood on my hands." Now, the remark angered Truman, who, of course, had been the decider for Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that really brought the meeting to an end. And afterwards, Truman told Undersecretary of State Dean Acheson, who had arranged the meeting, and I quote, "I don't ever want to see that son of a bitch in my office again." And even 6 months later, Truman referred to Oppenheimer as that crybaby scientist. Oppenheimer, who could charm almost anyone, had lost his cool. The enormity of the issue, its importance to him, his own political inexperience, the aura of the Oval Office, and Truman's ignorant statement had shattered his calculated confidence. With that disastrous interview, Oppenheimer lost the ear of the President of the United States, who was potentially his most important ally. About a month later, actually 3 weeks later, on November 16, 1945, Oppenheimer spoke to members of the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. It was a remarkably prescient speech. It was the first major speech he had prepared on the nuclear issue, and he touched many of the potential problems that nuclear weapons would bring to the world. And I just want to—I have a copy of the speech, and I want to play a couple of minutes of it so you can hear his voice and get a sense of the points, at least one of the points that he's making.
"Somewhat wrong to me to let our confidence, in my view, our wholly justified confidence in the future of the peaceful applications of nuclear physics, distract us entirely from the immediacy and the peril of atomic weapons. It would not be honest to do so, for not even a better understanding of the physical world, not even the most welcome developments of therapy, should make us content to see these weapons turn to the devastation of the Earth. It will not even be very practical to do so. Technically, the operation of reactors and the manufacture of weapons are rather closely related. Wherever reactors are in operation, there is a potential source, though not necessarily a convenient one, of materials for weapons. Wherever materials are made for weapons, they can be used for reactors that may be well suited to research or power development. It would seem to me almost inevitable in the world committed to atomic armament, the shadow of fear, secrecy, constraint, and guilt would hang heavy over much of nuclear physics, much of science. Scientists in this country have been quick to sense this and to attempt to escape it. I do not think that this attempt will be very successful in a world of atomic armament. There is another set of arguments whose intent it is to minimize the impact of atomic weapons and thus to delay or to avert the inevitably in the end radical changes in the world which their advent would seem to require. There are people who say that they are not such very bad weapons. Before the New Mexico test, we sometimes said that too, writing down square miles and equivalent tonnages and looking at the pictures of a ravaged Europe. After the test, we did not say it anymore. Some of you will have seen photos.
Now, a few months later, after that talk, Oppenheimer was appointed to a presidential panel, entrusted with the job of formulating a plan for the international control of atomic weapons. The administration's heart was not in it, but the effective lobbying of the Manhattan Project scientists, the so-called scientist movement, had created public pressure for such an initiative, and the White House kind of gave in and felt it could not ignore it. So Oppenheimer took charge of this group, and he persuaded his fellow panel members, including Dean Acheson, to endorse a dramatic, comprehensive, and remarkably prescient plan. Half measures, he had argued, were not sufficient. His proposal was to create an international agency that would monopolize all aspects of atomic energy and apportion its benefits as an incentive to individual countries. Such an agency would both control the technology and develop it for strictly civilian purposes. He argued that in the field of atomic energy, all countries should agree to partial renunciation of sovereignty. Now, that sounds like a radical step, but I simply remind you that that has occurred among the member governments of the European Union. So it is not an impossible occurrence. Accordingly, the proposed Atomic Development Authority would have sovereign ownership of all uranium mines, atomic power plants, and laboratories. No nation would be permitted to build atomic bombs, but scientists everywhere would still be allowed to exploit the atom for peaceful purposes. In some updated and modified formulation, something like Oppenheimer's plan for controlling the proliferation of nuclear weapons remains, even today, our best hope to avoid global nuclear weapons and the proliferation that goes with them. This is the view of Mohammed El-Baradei, the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency. In 2003, El-Baradei proposed a major overhaul of the current nuclear regime. He explained that information on how to produce nuclear weapons is now much more accessible than ever before, and that spent nuclear fuel and radioactive waste is now stockpiled in more than 50 countries. 50 countries. He concluded that the whole non-proliferation regime is undergoing difficult stress. El-Baradei's antidote to collapse is a proposal that is very similar to the proposal that Oppenheimer and his committee optimistically submitted to the White House over 60 years ago in February 1946. It was called at the time the Acheson-Lilienthal Report. Oppenheimer's proposal for an International Atomic Development Authority was not greeted enthusiastically by the Truman administration. Secretary of State Burns made a pretense of saying that he was impressed. But in fact, he was shocked by the sweeping scope of the report's recommendations. And he persuaded President Truman to appoint his, meaning Burns's, longtime business partner, Wall Street financier Bernard Baruch, to translate, as Burns put it, the administration's proposals to the United Nations. Dean Acheson was appalled by Baruch's appointment, And when Oppenheimer heard of it, he simply said, "We're lost." In private, Baruch was already expressing grave reservations about Acheson Lilienthal report recommendations. And he turned to two conservative bankers and a mining engineer for advice. Baruch, the mining engineer, and the Secretary of State, James Burns, just happened to be board members and investors in Newmont Mining Corporation, a major company with a large stake in uranium mines. Not surprisingly, they were alarmed by the very idea that privately owned mines might be turned over to an international development authority. And Baruch already was speaking about the atomic bomb as our winning weapon. This attitude that nuclear weapons are a panacea, a cure-all for America's diplomatic and military problems, already had come to dominate the Truman administration. Within a few years, this attitude, the psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton has called it nuclearism, would seep into the mainstream of American political culture. And from there, it would migrate abroad to other nations in a transfer of American thinking that ultimately endangered the existence of everyone on Earth. What Baruch submitted to the United Nations was not a plan for the cooperative control over nuclear energy, but a non-proliferation agreement designed to preserve the American monopoly of atomic weapons. On June 14, 1946, Baruch presented this plan and dramatically stated that he was offering the world a choice between the quick and the dead. As Oppenheimer and others associated with the original Acheson-Lilienthal plan predicted, Baruch's proposals were promptly rejected by the Soviets. Moscow's diplomats instead proposed a simple treaty to ban the production or use of atomic weapons and disarmament. Oppenheimer told Kitty over the phone the next day that the Soviet proposal was, quote, not too bad. And we know what he said because the FBI was tapping his telephone made a transcript of it, and it was available to Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin. Now, I must tell you that the research assistance that Kai and I got from the FBI was terrific. And they really are great research assistants when it comes to tapping phones and that sort of thing. Very helpful to biographers. Anyway, that's an aside. The Truman administration rejected the Soviet response out of hand. Negotiations continued in a fashion that got us nowhere and went to no end. An early opportunity had been lost to make a serious effort at preventing an uncontrolled nuclear arms race between the two major powers. It would take the terrors of 1962 in the Cuban Missile Crisis and the massive Soviet buildup that followed it before an American administration in the 1970s would propose a serious and acceptable arms control agreement. But then it was too late. Tens of thousands of nuclear warheads had been built. The so-called arms control regime became no more and no less than a collection of speed limits and traffic lights that guided the nuclear powers along the escalation highway. In June 1946, more or less at the time that Baruch was presenting his plan, Oppenheimer wrote in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, quote, "Every American knows that if there is another major war, atomic weapons will be used. We know this because in the last war, the two nations which we like to think are the most enlightened and humane in the world, Great Britain and the United States, used atomic weapons against an enemy which was essentially defeated," unquote. This was an extraordinary thing to say. Less than a year after the events of August 1945, the man who had instructed the bombardiers exactly how to drop their atomic bombs on the center of two Japanese cities stated publicly that he had been an accessory to a horrible mistake, possibly a crime. The use of atomic weapons against, quote, an enemy which was essentially defeated. Let's fast forward now to 1949, August of 1949, when the Soviets tested their own atomic bomb. Within a few weeks, Edward Teller was lobbying furiously and effectively to escalate the nuclear arms race again by committing the United States to a crash program to build a hydrogen bomb, a fusion weapon thousands of times more powerful than atomic fission bombs. The General Advisory Committee to the Atomic Energy Commission, of which Oppenheimer was the chair, was asked to consider Edward Teller's proposal, and it unanimously rejected the idea, concluding that the hydrogen bomb was not necessary. American security, they argued, was sufficiently protected by our stockpile of atomic bombs. They were a sufficient deterrent even if the Soviets managed to get a hydrogen bomb first. Furthermore, they said, the hydrogen bomb, or super as it was then called, was a weapon of genocide, a term they used, too large to have any military use. It could only be used to annihilate civilian urban populations. Rather than enter a crash program for a hydrogen bomb, Oppenheimer and his colleagues proposed a program of sufficiency and arms control that was, as it turned out, 20 years ahead of its time. They recommended, in addition, that the Soviet achievement be viewed as an opportunity rather than a threat. It created an opening to discuss mutual assured stability by announcing a unilateral American policy not to build a hydrogen bomb. A weapon, by the way, that could not be built without being first tested, and any test was certain to be detected. And they pointed out why such a policy provided more rather than less security. But by 1949, nuclearism was deeply embedded in the corridors of American power, where American diplomacy and military policy were formed, and work on the hydrogen bomb was encouraged and supported by President Truman. For nearly 5 years, Oppenheimer had tried to use his prestige to influence Washington's growing national security establishment from the inside, and he had failed. By 1953, however, at the very height of the McCarthy era, Oppenheimer came to the conclusion that he had to speak out publicly. He could not have chosen a more dangerous time. He spoke out at the Council of Foreign Relations, criticizing the military's penchant for nuclear secrecy. He criticized our nuclear war plans in print, and generally, finally, said publicly what he had been arguing in the councils of governments for years. As word spread through Washington's national security bureaucracy of what Oppenheimer was saying and writing, many were appalled, but none more than Louis L. Strauss, the man President Eisenhower had recently appointed chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission. Strauss was a conservative Wall Street investment banker and a devout believer in the American nuclear arsenal. Moreover, he knew Oppenheimer well, and they shared a mutual dislike that had grown into enmity. Since 1947, they had clashed repeatedly over large and petty issues. And by 1953, Strauss had decided that Oppenheimer might well be a Soviet agent. He had no evidence, but Oppenheimer's past left-wing associations that I had talked about during the 1930s and his opposition to the hydrogen bomb fed Strauss's suspicions, which he eagerly shared with FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. But if he could not prove that Oppenheimer was a spy, Strauss nevertheless decided that Oppenheimer's influence and prestige constituted a threat to national security. So over the next year, In concert with J. Edgar Hoover, Edward Teller, and some others, Strauss orchestrated a campaign to strip Oppenheimer of his security clearance. With Strauss's encouragement and approval, one of the conspirators wrote a letter to Hoover in November 1953, stating that, quote, more probably than not, J. Robert Oppenheimer is an agent of the Soviet Union, unquote. As baseless as the charges were, they provided Strauss with the opportunity he had been waiting for to move against Oppenheimer. And on December 23, 1953, he informed Oppenheimer in a letter that his security clearance was suspended. His former communist associations and his opposition to the hydrogen bomb were cited as evidence of his uncertain reliability. In May of 1954, after a grueling 6-week long security hearing that was corrupted by the Atomic Energy Commission's refusal to grant any of Oppenheimer's attorneys a security clearance, by illegal FBI telephone taps of Oppenheimer and Oppenheimer's attorney's office, and outrageous witness tampering by the AEC's prosecuting attorney, a biased hearing board declared in a 2-1 decision that Oppenheimer, though a loyal American, nevertheless was a security risk. His appeal to the Atomic Energy Commissioners was rejected, possibly due to a successful bribery campaign by Louis Strauss. And in an effort to further embarrass Oppenheimer, Strauss had the confidential transcript of the hearing published, with the most damaging testimony highlighted for reporters who were on deadline when the transcript was made available. But in the long run, Strauss's strategy backfired. The transcript, which carried the title, In the Matter of J. Robert Oppenheimer, revealed the inquisitorial character of the hearing, martyred Oppenheimer, and became a documentary record that exposed the corruption of justice during the McCarthy period. It should be required reading in our Patriot Act constructed world. In fact, the violations of federal regulations and due process were so outrageous during that hearing that a distinguished Washington law firm, Arnold and Porter, has taken responsibility on a pro bono basis to have that hearing nullified. So what were the consequences of that Star Chamber proceeding? Well, for Oppenheimer, they were devastating. His friend Isidore Rabi said simply, it simply killed him. It destroyed him completely. And there were larger consequences, too. The hearing removed a powerful voice, an important, intelligent, alternative view from the debate over the role that nuclear weapons should play in American policy. And with the Oppenheimer verdict, all scientists were put on notice that dissenting views carried serious consequences. Oppenheimer's humiliation was also a defeat for American liberalism. Liberals had embraced Oppenheimer as one of their own, and his humiliation implicated liberalism. For decades afterwards, liberal politicians were put on notice that questioning America's reliance on a nuclear arsenal was forbidden territory. As Oppenheimer tried to warn us, those weapons allow the weakest states, or even a handful of angry young men, to threaten the obliteration of our cities. Recently, this view has been promoted by a most surprising, to me at least, gang of four. Former Secretaries of State George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of Defense William Perry, and former Senator Sam Nunn wrote an op-ed in the January 4th Wall Street Journal entitled, A World Free of Nuclear Weapons. And I quote from the first paragraph. Nuclear weapons today present tremendous dangers, but also an historic opportunity. U.S. leaders will be required to take the world to the next stage, to a solid consensus for reversing reliance on nuclear weapons globally, and ultimately ending them as a threat to the world. Oppenheimer, who died of throat cancer in February 1967, would have been glad to sign that letter, for his nuclear world and ours are linked by the same grand delusion that he warned against, that nuclear weapons are a panacea, a cure-all for our diplomatic and military problems. It was and remains a false and dangerous hope. The important work of eliminating nuclear weapons that Oppenheimer started must be continued. And as the four former nuclear enthusiasts finally recognize, the United States must lead the way. We owe this not only to ourselves, to our children, but to our grandchildren and their children. If President Ronald Reagan could promote the elimination of nuclear weapons, as he did when he met with Gorbachev at Reykjavik in 1986, surely there is hope. So I'll give the last word to the former governor of California, whose signature is on my University of California PhD certificate. Nuclear weapons are, Reagan said, totally irrational, totally inhumane, good for nothing but killing, possibly destructive of life on Earth and civilization. I am glad he got that right. I only wish his learning curve had been steeper. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Schoen, for that brilliant lecture. I just want to let everyone know the format for the rest of the evening. Professor Hasegawa will be engaging Professor Schoen in a 15 to 20 minute conversation. We'll follow that with your questions. We have microphones here at the front of the stage. Please use those so we can record you for University of California Television. Following that, we'll bring two tables out and we'll do a book signing. Books are available by both authors in the lobby. Please welcome Professor Hasegawa.
Thank you. I'm sure you agree with the spellbinding presentation. As Roman said, originally we intended to have 15 minutes of dialogue because I think, as Martin said, that they wrote a book called Racing the Enemy, Stalin, Truman, and the Surrender of Japan. And in this book, there are lots of things that intersect with Oppenheimer and then also with his book. Many of you have come to listen to my Sherwin and not my talk. After all, Sherwin's book won the Pulitzer Prize and mine didn't. And so, rather than wasting my time here dialogue, that what I would like to do is to introduce some of the main arguments that I developed in this book, and then probably I think I could ask Martin to comment on this, and then and I comment on his comments, and then you know this exchange would stop at a certain point, and then I open up for question and an answer session. My book is to place this whole issue of Japanese surrender, atomic bomb, and Soviet entry into international context. Basically, I advance two arguments. That is, in the Pacific War, there was fierce competition between Truman and Stalin. That Truman wanted to force Japan to surrender before Soviets entered the war. And Stalin, on the other hand, wanted to join the war before Japan surrendered to the United States alone. And in that competition, the atomic bomb played a very, very important role. Truman managed to drop the bomb on Hiroshima in August 6th before the Soviet entered the war. But immediately after the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima, Stalin moved up the day of attack on Japan by 48 hours, and he succeeded in joining the war in the nick of time. And so this is one argument that I advance. And the second thing is that I'm sure that there are here in the audience who believe that it is the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki that played a very decisive role. In fact, that the immediate decisive role on Japanese surrender. And my second argument that I develop in this book is challenge this conventional view, very widely held in the United States, that if you really examine very detail in the Japanese decision-making process, it is not the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki that was decisive. I think more decisive was the Soviet entry into the war. So this is on this sobering note, then I stop here, then probably I might ask your comments on this, and then probably we can go on to the question and answer session.
Well, the first thing is, while I was standing here and listening to Toshi, I had shown my class several weeks ago a videotape of the Kennedy-Nixon debates. And I had never stood on a stage with two podiums and two people facing each other, and I had this weird sense that I was reliving the Kennedy-Nixon debate format here, except that it's really not a debate. I found Professor Hasegawa's book incredibly well researched, the argument extremely persuasive and detailed, and frankly, I don't think it. And frankly, I do think it's going to be the last word, but perhaps the best word, the most solid word on this issue. The entry of the Soviet Union into the war was clearly a tremendous blow to those Japanese in the Emperor's inner circle who were arguing for continuing the war. And the reason it was such a devastating blow is that, first of all, everyone recognized that Japan was defeated. The question was how to get the best surrender terms. And the military representatives who were arguing most powerfully for continuing the war against some of the civilians who were willing to accept the Potsdam Declaration, for example, as the basis upon which to end the war, provided unconditional surrender with respect to the emperor was clarified, that the emperor would not be held accountable as a war criminal. Those military members argued that the Soviet Union can be persuaded to mediate between Japan and the United States so that the Japan can get the terms that the military wanted to surrender under. Well, once the Soviet Union came into the war, there was no argument left. Not only had the rug been pulled out from under them, the entire floor had collapsed. When the emperor addressed the military about the end of the war, and I think it must have been August 15th or something like that, he never mentioned the atomic bomb. He mentioned the entry of the Soviet Union into the war against Japan. Now, this is a very difficult thing for America as a culture to accept, because it suggests, as Oppenheimer stated in that Bulletin of Atomic Scientists piece of June 1946, that we had used the atomic bomb against an essentially defeated enemy. And the implications of that are very uncomfortable, to say the least. But that's where the evidence is. And the real question becomes, you know, how much of that was understood by Truman, by Burns, who was probably more responsible than Truman for making that decision. The argument that was put forward by Stimson in the Harper's Magazine piece in February 1947 called The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb, which became the major orthodox explanation of why we used it, completely distorted the facts, as Stimson himself had understood it, because it said that there had been a choice between using the bomb and the invasion of Japan. Well, that was a very clever construction as a way of justifying the use of the bomb, because nobody argues, nobody can argue, really, that it would have been better to have an invasion than to use the bomb, because we all know that at least as many people would have been killed in an invasion, Japanese, let alone all the Americans. It was not a million. The figures aren't the important point. The point is that that was not the choice. The choice was the one Professor Hasegawa made clear, this race for the United States to try to end the war before the Soviets came in. Sorry to go on so long.
Well, I think he agrees with me. Probably there's no sense for me to comment on it. I think what I'm going to do, we're going to do, is we're going to shift to question and an answer and session. And then as Roman mentioned, that if you have questions, you can come in front and then talk. But let me first, let me just ask him my first question. Right. Let's go back to Oppenheimer. You mentioned that he and scientist Manhattan project were not informed of what was really happening in the political level, and he later on felt deceived by the politicians. And yet, in your book, in other words, he had these misgivings about his role in developing atomic bomb. And yet that later on in your book that we mentioned some British playwright wrote a play on a
German playwright, Kippard.
And then is at the end, there's a monologue there that Oppenheimer was depicted as this regretting his role. And you said that Oppenheimer was very, very angry with that. And so, seems to me there's a contradiction. What was that? He was very proud of that achievement on developing atomic bomb and Manhattan Project. At the same time, he had a regret. And then I think, it seems to me that your subtitle, Robert Oppenheimer, I mean, American Prometheus, and Triumph and Tragedy of Robert Oppenheimer, I think seems to me that I don't know what you meant by the triumph
It's at the same time, that was tragedy.
That's what I meant.
Uh-huh. No disagreement again.
You know, one of the most interesting things about Oppenheimer is that he tried to always be on both sides of the argument, if there were two sides. Sometimes there were three or four sides. And that's one of the ways he got in trouble. It's one of the ways he got in emotional trouble. It's one of the ways he got in political trouble. And with respect to the atomic use of the atomic bomb itself, until we, Kai and I, dug up the sort of the full collection of Oppenheimer's writings about the atomic bomb, most people believed, including me when I first went into this project, that Oppenheimer never regretted using the atomic bomb because he had made that statement to Truman, "I have blood on my hands." I had not known until I found that small paragraph in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists about using the bomb against an essentially defeated enemy, that he had written that. By 1947, when he was brought into the government advisory circles and became the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission's General Advisory Committee, he switched off his angst about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and essentially put it in the back of his mind and didn't talk about it anymore. And he never expressed again serious criticism of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And there's... Toshi asked me when we were going to dinner about Oppenheimer's visit to Japan. And it was sometime in the 1960s, and he at the airport, he's asked by a reporter how he feels about Hiroshima. And he says something like, "I don't feel any worse than I have felt for 20 years or something like that." I forget the exact quotation. But it was one of these totally obscure comments. I mean, what does it mean? And we make the comment in the book, this must have been very hard to translate into Japanese. It's hard to translate into English. he was just the kind of person who took positions that he felt he had to take at a particular time, commensurate with, I guess, his ambitions, his responsibilities, or whatever else seemed to motivate him.
The floor is open for questions. Go ahead.
Points, not necessarily.
I think you want to talk right into the mic. Okay.
A couple of points, not necessarily related, but I'd be interested in your response on both of them. Was Oppenheimer's opponent Strauss, was that the same Leo Strauss who fathered the neoconservative movement currently occupying the White House?
No.
No, okay. And I've drawn a blank on my second question, sorry.
I'll just elaborate. Nor was it the Strauss related to, what was it, Sears Roebuck or... Louis Strauss was a self-made man. He was... he didn't go to college because he couldn't afford to. He did go to work for Herbert Hoover. He went from Hoover to, after World War I, to a major financial firm in New York, married the boss's daughter, and became very wealthy, and used the money to become involved at a very high level in politics. You remembered your second.
Yes.
Was the Schultz, Perry, and two others, was their surprising advocacy for nuclear disarmament, was that in response to the doomsday clock being moved 2 minutes closer to midnight at the beginning of the year?
You mean that the letter that I talked about in the Wall Street Journal?
Yes.
That was in response to a study that had been done, as they explain in the letter, at the Hoover Institution at Palo Alto. And there is a group of conservatives who are moving in a very different direction. And they've come to the conclusion correctly that nuclear weapons today, you know, they still justify nuclear weapons in the Cold War, but nuclear weapons today are more of a threat to the United States than they are in any possible way an advantage. And, you know, Stimson said at the Potsdam conference when he heard about the July 16th, 1945 successful test of the atomic bomb, he said, now we have the great equalizer. And what he was talking about was the atomic bomb now equalized America's power in Europe or anywhere else to the very large number of Soviet conventional forces. Well, the great equalizer concept has come home to roost. Now North Korea has the great equalizer. Now Pakistan and India have the great equalizer, and so on and so forth. And now Iran wants to get the great equalizer. Nuclear weapons are, in fact, a very useful deterrence for small nations vis-a-vis the United States. In the long run, it's to their disadvantage, but to the short run, they see it as an advantage. And now the United States has to make a choice. Are we going to reverse course completely and do what we can over a very long period of time trying to eliminate nuclear weapons from the arsenals of the governments of the world? Or are we going to keep the belief that our nuclear weapons are good because we're good and we're responsible, and the nuclear weapons in the hands of anybody except our best allies are dangerous and bad? And if we continue down that road, I'm very pessimistic about the consequences.
Very powerful. Thank you.
Hi, if I a short comment and then a longer question. I would say instead of the great equalizer, it's the great destabilizer, if you look at the actual consequences. But the longer question in terms of the history of the Japanese surrender and the Soviet entry is the following question. The Soviet leadership was well aware of the U.S. program through Klaus Fuchs and others within the Manhattan Project. They knew about the U.S. efforts. They knew about our progress. They knew about the Trinity test. And, in fact, they knew about the Japanese bombings to some extent before they happened. So the question is that Stalin could have declared war on Japan at any point. And
just a clarification.
Yes.
They knew about what before it happened?
So they knew of the U.S. intention to bomb Japan before Japan was bombed.
I don't believe that's right, but
well,
go ahead.
I think that is, if you look at the history. But that's, that point is not relevant. Certainly the Soviet Union knew of the U.S. effort, and they were very well aware of what we were doing. They could have declared war on Japan at any point, but their main interest was in Europe, not in Japan, in terms of their overall scheme in world politics at that point. So my question is it possible that the Soviets entered the war precisely because the U.S. attacked Japan with nuclear weapons, and therefore that is why the Japanese gave up at that point, because the Soviets entered the war because the U.S. dropped nuclear weapons?
I think we both should comment on that, but my comment is that there was no question but that the Soviets were going to enter the war no later than August 15th. It is very likely that the Soviets moved up their entry into the war by possibly as much as a week, but possibly only by a day or two. Because we dropped the bomb on August 6th. They entered the war. They entered the war on August 9th, 8th, 9th, 8th.
August 9th.
9th, right.
9th. I mean, in Washington time, August 8th.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's August 9th. August 9th, and what 0 hours on August 9th in the Far East. Yeah.
But what is your understanding as to why they didn't enter the war earlier? To what advantage was there to enter the war?
I mean, the Soviets were fighting
another front.
Four-fifths of the Wehrmacht on the eastern, you know, on their front. And Stalin had promised the last time at Yalta that he would enter the war 3 months after Germany surrendered. Germany surrendered on May 8th. They entered the war on May 8th, May 9th. The reason for that three-month delay was that they had to move troops all the way across from Western Soviet Union, the so-called Eastern Front, all the way to the Pacific Front. I mean, it was an enormous number of troops that had to be moved. So it took that long. I mean, just think of the run-up time to both Iraq wars. You know, with modern transportation and relatively smaller number of forces necessary, and you can understand, you know, the three-month delay.
Well, my response to you is that Soviet Manchurian operation is a really, really large-scale military operation. It's one of the largest, you know, that Manchurian operation is about four or five times as big as the size of France, and then Soviet operation is the most important aspect of Soviet operation, surprise. And then the idea is to start operation at the same time, on the same day, at the same time, right? And so the Soviet military planners are very afraid of premature attack. And Stalin was in constant consultation with the military commanders. Military commanders were very, very careful that we could not really attack the Japanese prematurely, because that would really spoil the whole thing. And I don't think that they had a luxury of attacking earlier. Even moving up the date for 48 hours, I think it's a very, very risky operation, as Soviet military planners recognize. Now, as for the atomic bomb, of course, the Soviet Union knew that the United States was developing atomic bomb, and they have, of course, Klaus Fuchs and others, I mean, they are spies. But my guess, we don't know, this is a still very unknown, uncertain things, but my guess is that Stalin and others did not expect the United States to be able to drop the bomb so quickly. And so, so that when it indeed the United States dropped the bomb on the Hiroshima, it was a great surprise. And then I think there's indication that Stalin was really shocked and then thought that the atomic bomb would do the job and Japan would surrender. And as I mentioned in my book, that the thing is the Japanese didn't surrender immediately because Japan was still hoping for the mediation with the Soviet Union. And so taking advantage of it, Stalin just ordered the attack for the attack of on Japan for 48 hours, and he just managed to join the war in a nuclear time. I think that your assumption that, well, Stalin could have, you know, started the war earlier, I think it's easier to say, but I don't think that was possible. This is not the way the Soviet military planners thought.
I'm confused by the way you have described the motivations of the Truman administration. On the one hand, you've said that they were in a race with the Soviets conscious race with the Soviets to try to end the war in Japan before, get a Japanese surrender before the Soviets entered the war. But then you also say they bypassed an easy route of doing that by just clarifying terms of surrender in a minor way. So that's, it makes the Truman administration look really irrational, and I don't think they operated quite that insanely.
I don't quite understand the question. Could you?
I think I got it. On the one hand, one of us is arguing that the Truman administration did not clarify unconditional surrender, and that could have brought about an earlier surrender.
Definitely, that's what you said, yeah.
Right.
Much earlier.
I said that.
Long before the Soviets were prepared to enter the war. Mm-hmm.
And the other hand, that the bomb was dropped in order to get the war over before the Soviets came in.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, you know, a lot of other efforts were expended to accelerate the war.
Well, first of all, you know, there were these different problems. There's the international problem, there's the domestic problem. James Burns, the Secretary of State for Truman, who was a very well-informed person on foreign policy, known during the Roosevelt administration as Mr. Assistant President. James Burns, who had been at Yalta and was the only man who took notes in shorthand about the Yalta conversations. James Burns, who expected to be picked by Roosevelt as vice president, but was blackballed by the liberal Democrats, and Truman was the compromise candidate, knew a great deal about foreign policy compared to Harry Truman, who, when he came in, knew virtually nothing about foreign policy. So during those war months, Harry Truman relied significantly on James Burns' advice. Mm-hmm. And Burns said, modifying or clarifying unconditional surrender would be a political disaster. He was totally against it. He felt this was Roosevelt's policy, that the United States, you know, believed, the American people believed in it, and we had to insist on unconditional surrender. And he did not know anything about Japan, and he didn't believe that anything was going to bring about the Japanese surrender except, you know, the atomic bomb or something like that. All the American experts who, in the State Department, said and told Truman that clarifying the emperor's status after the war will bring about surrender in their judgment. But Burns had the most influence over Truman. And that's the answer to why, at least my answer to why unconditional surrender was not clarified with respect to the emperor.
Well, let me answer your question the following way. Martin said that I think there are always alternatives. And I believe that the use of atomic bomb, I think that the Truman administration used atomic bomb to force Japan to surrender. This is where I disagree with some of the revisionists who say that this is merely diplomatic weapon to scare the Soviets. I think that they used the bomb to force Japan to surrender. But if this sole purpose of use the bomb was to minimize the cost, human cost, right, in the of American soldiers, then there are two alternatives that he could have taken. One is precisely what Martin said, that there was a list to revise unconditional surrender in such a way that some, at least some of the Japanese government people might be more amenable to the early conclusion of the peace. If the United States had revised unconditional unconditional surrender in such a way, will the Japanese government immediately accept the surrender? This is questionable, but there is no question in my mind. But that kind of amendment would have really forced the party within the Japanese government favoring the early termination, reinforce that power, and then very, very subtly shift the power balance between the war party and the peace party. This is the first alternative. The second alternative is simply wait for the Soviet entry into the war, right? And there's a Potsdam Proclamation issued to Japan on July 26th. And this draft of Potsdam Proclamation was actually written by Stimson, and it was given to Truman in July the 2nd. And in that proclamation, there are two very important things there. That one, Stimson included a passage where the United States would allow the Japanese to maintain monarchical system. Right? This is a major revision of conditional surrender. And second thing of that proclamation is very, very important, is that Stimson thought that the Soviet Union would also sign that the Potsdam Proclamation. When indeed the Potsdam Proclamation was issued, Truman and Burns revised this. At first, he just totally eliminated the passage about the preservation of monarchical system. And secondly, they totally eliminated the possibility of Stalin signing the Potsdam Proclamation. In fact, Stalin was not consulted at all. And so that when it was issued to Japan, the Japanese noticed two things. One, there's nothing to be said about the emperor, and Stalin didn't sign. And so that you could argue that had Truman maintained that original Stimson's report, then things might have happened, right? Mm-hmm. So that's my point. Okay.
Anything?